Argument is Blue Cross versus Cruz, Mr. Shelley.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Anthony Shelley here on behalf of the plaintiff appellants in the case, Healthcare Services Corporation and Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. Before beginning my argument, I'd like to apprise the court of a development in the state court suit, the suit that the plaintiff says this court should defer to. In that action, the United States has now taken the extraordinary step of making an appearance in that action and filing a notice of special interest. That suit, which is, in our view, it's a putative class action designed to litigate an offset defense to this one, the United States has said it is barred by sovereign immunity because it seeks to invalidate the reimbursement terms of their government contract. And the government has also said it's barred by sovereign immunity because...
Well, did you ask OPM to participate in this case?
Your Honor, we did, and I don't speak for the government, but the United States, I think, sees the state court action as an action that's coercive to its interests. This one is one where we're seeking to further the government's interests. I would certainly invite the court to seek OPM's interest, and I'd be happy to file what the United States has filed in the state court, but I can't answer for why the United States is not here.
But you asked them, so apparently they're not all that interested.
Well, one thing the United States said also in its brief in the state court was that the Justice Department wasn't prepared to do anything until after the briefing closed in this case. But the United States does take the position also that this whole area is preempted by federal law and that it's...
What do you mean by the whole area is preempted by federal law? Suppose the court hired a private cleaning service and one of the employees of the cleaning service had a dispute with his supervisor and they got into a fist fight or something and the employee sued the supervisor or sued the cleaning service for battery or something. Is it your view that suit would be removable into federal court?
Well, no, Your Honor, unless there was a federal government contract that covered the area of dispute.
Yes, of course there's a federal government. I said this is a cleaning service hired by the federal government. That's the way the federal government hires Blue Cross to provide benefits. So why isn't it the same case?
Well, if one party was seeking to enforce the government contract or assert its rights under the government contract, the answer would be yes. The case would be governed by federal common law because a government contract is enforceable only via federal common law.
In such a case, the argument for preemption would be that if the cleaning service has some broad scope of liability to the employee, this is going to increase the cleaning service's costs and therefore the government's contract costs.
Well, if you want to go to the Boyle analysis as opposed to this one being, additionally to the Boyle analysis, this case being one to actually enforce the terms of the contract under Boyle,
But you are arguing under Boyle.
That's right.
Well,
we are arguing both.
Yes. And under Boyle, is there any stopping point under Boyle short of preemption of all disputes arising out of government contracts?
Yes. A suit that involves a government contract does involve uniquely federal interests, regardless of the context, really, if it would increase the government's costs.
As in my example.
But in addition, there has to be a significant conflict between the application of state law and the operation and federal policies. Now, I don't know if in that situation there would be specific federal policies favoring uniformity across the board or cost containment.
Well, what was the specific collision in the Boyle case?
It was a situation where there was a discretionary function that the government had taken on in setting out the terms of the particular military equipment at issue in the case. The government had set forth the contracts and specifications for the military equipment. When it crashed, the party that manufactured it was sued for a design defect, and it all went back to the terms the government had specified. And so the court said that that went to the government's discretion, and therefore federal common law would govern because the United States had interests, and it would also upset the discretionary functions of the government.
Listen, isn't there a de minimis factor here, though, that the impact in this particular case is so small?
Well, I don't think there's a de minimis factor in the sense of I don't think there is a de minimis factor. I think any case that involves the enforcement of a federal government contract, even $1, raises a federal question. But this case, in this lawsuit, involves a single employee. But if the law were that these sorts of cases couldn't be brought in federal court, weren't governed by a uniform body of federal law, it has a larger effect than just this one case.
Why didn't Blue Cross, though, permit this attorney's fees deduction? Because I thought its policy was that it permits the deduction in small cases so that people will have an incentive to sue, since the judgment will be an offset to Blue Cross's obligations. And it's only in the huge cases where the incentive to sue is unaffected by the treatment of attorney's fees that it withholds its consent.
Blue Cross attempted to work this out. But before it could be worked out, we were sued in a class action in state court by the defendant here, who sought to litigate the issue. There's a dispute between the parties, and therefore we're here in the forum we think is the correct one. Their case is really a defense to this one, and that's why we're here, to protect the government's interests and the provisions of the government contract.
Who sued first, you or the?
They sued in state court in anticipation, really, of a reimbursement claim on our part. They sued simply for a declaration, other relief too, but a declaration that the plan violates Illinois law. In a way, if you turn that case around, as you have to do in a declaratory judgment suit, the coercive suit is our suit, which is the one here. And that case, we think, raises federal questions because it's governed by federal common law. We've talked a bit about the Boyle test already. One thing that the district court did was it misread the Boyle case as in thinking that there is a de minimis exception, that it relied on the Howard case from the Tenth Circuit from early on in the 80s, but that predated Boyle, and therefore we think the district court relied on the wrong case law. In addition to the significant conflict...
They brought their state court suit a year before your suit.
I don't think it was entirely a year. Well, the case was removed also. The case was removed, and there was a lot of litigation over removal. And obviously, if the case had been in federal court, this case conceivably wouldn't have been brought. But when it went back to state court, we brought it to the right forum for our own claim.
You don't want to fight it out in state court.
Well, we are at this point. But we think the appropriate forum is this one for the case. The other interest that there's a significant conflict with is the government's interest in cost containment. I would point the court to the Eighth Circuit's decision.
But the other case would resolve this case, but this case can't resolve the other case. Isn't that correct?
I think that's wrong. I think the other case can't resolve this one, but this
one
can resolve that one.
The other case has the class. And
there's
Cruise
no class that's been certified.
Pardon?
No class has been certified in that action. It's a putative class action.
But Cruise is in that suit along with a lot of other people.
Well, he's the only named plaintiff in this plan. There are some ERISA or other.
But he's trying to bring it as a class action.
Yes.
But certification hasn't been rejected; just hasn't been decided.
Well, the case has been pending for 4 years, but a motion has been filed, but it's never been acted upon by the other side. Whether it will, we're litigating
what
summary
do you
mean judgment motions.
Other side, I don't understand.
Well, it was filed. The class certification motion.
You're
was,
the other side, aren't you?
Well, it's filed by my opponent in this case, the plaintiff in the state court. They filed the motion to certify the class early on.
And did you respond to that motion?
No, because it was never set for a hearing, and the court never set it for argument. The case then sat for several years while it was stayed so that other claims could be worked out.
But it would be correct that if it were certified, then that case would provide the vehicle for resolving the entire dispute, whereas this case will just resolve the dispute with Cruz.
I think that's wrong. This case has... Mr. Cruz has never paid any money back to the plan. The only issues in that case are the offset defense. We'd still have an entitlement to the main principal amount that's not at issue.
Well, they don't deny that you're entitled to some reimbursement, do they?
Well, there's been no stipulation of that. There's been no answer.
Well, they said that in their brief.
Well, they did say it in their brief, but the district court didn't agree with that necessarily. In the beginning of the case, in her decision, she noted that that case is smaller than this one in the sense that it's only a defense to the larger claim in this case. But Mr. Cruz is the only named plaintiff in that case who's in this plan, and therefore, if he were to lose this case, if the court were to hold that this area is governed by federal common law, it would bar him from further litigation in the state court on that. And the only thing that could conceivably happen is that the lawyers could go out and try to find another plaintiff. And I don't know that they'll be successful with that, and it may be not possible at this point since the class hasn't been certified yet. And there's law in Illinois suggesting that, well, if you haven't certified a class and the plaintiff's claim, the named plaintiff's claim is mooted, you're done.
That's true.
What I'd like to also mention is this court's decision in Harris. In that case, the issue did come up as to whether the cases to enforce or interpret the terms of a federal government contract, particularly this one, whether they're governed by federal common law, and this court held that it was. The defendant in this case has actually asserted that the case was wrongly decided, that it was hastily decided, but it was decided. And this court held that federal law governs the interpretation of federal government contracts in this setting. And it's just it's part of a larger body of law holding that the enforcement of federal government contracts is governed exclusively by federal law. And this court's decision in the Western Securities case, I believe Judge Posner's decision, specifically holds that if you're seeking to enforce the terms of a government contract, the case arises.
So the rejection of this collective fund doctrine, this is actually in your contract with the U.S.?
What the contract says... the contract terms say that reimbursement shall be done according to the brochure, which is attached to the contract. It incorporates the brochure. The brochure then says we have a right to full reimbursement, 100%, and it says that...
So you're saying that the federal contract incorporates by reference the rejection of the collective fund.
That's right. In Section 2.2 of the contract and also Section 2.5 of the contract, they both say that the terms of this brochure are part of the contract. Section 2.5 specifically says that reimbursement shall be done under the contract only consistent with the terms of the brochure. And it's in the brochure, which is part of the contract, that all of our rights are set out, and there's a specific statement in there that attorney's fees, there shall not be a reduction for attorney's fees unless there's prior approval from the plan. And there was no such approval here. And therefore, under the terms of the plan, there can be no reduction at this point. State law can't force it. Only the discretion of the carrier, governed by directions from the government itself, can result in the reduction.
Are they required to notify you of as what happened here? They sued and recovered? Is there a requirement?
There is. In the reimbursement terms, which are set out in the appendix that are in the brochure, it's a long page in the brochure that indicates everything they have to do.
And they did so?
I believe they did. And we tried to work it out, and it led to litigation. I'd like to save the remainder.
Well, is the notion that you're a third-party beneficiary of this? Well, no,
we're a party.
You're a part of the contract.
The United States is a party.
So what is what is Cruz, then?
Cruz is an enrollee in a federal program. The federal government contract between...
No, I know that, but I mean, it is...
Yes, a third-party beneficiary.
In what sense are you enforcing...
The plan has the right to seek reimbursement if money is collected from the third party, and the
right. That's your contractual right against Cruz. That's so.
Well, we don't have a contract with Cruz. We have no contract with Mr. Cruz. He's only a subscriber in this program. The contract is between the United States and us, and
surely you have a contractual relationship with Cruz.
No, we don't. We have no signed contract
understand.
Between the two
if
of
Cruz,
us.
If you didn't pay, forget about this case. If he has some entitlement to benefits and you don't pay him, he can sue you.
Well, as a third-party beneficiary to the contract.
Well, that's fine, but he can sue you. That means he has contractual rights against you.
Well, except in this case, the government has specifically said in the ways that suits can be brought, for instance, and he can't sue a carrier, for instance, to get benefits back. He has to sue the government to get benefits back.
Really?
Yes. There's a provision in the regulations and in the contract that say the government is the defendant in uh-huh. suits for benefits.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Shelley. Mr. Carnath? Mr. Shelley, sorry. Mr. Carnath?
May it please the court, Michael Carnuth on behalf of defendant Jose Cruz. In response to Judge Posner's inquiry about the government's interest in this case, Blue Cross's counsel indicated that they filed a statement in the state court action. They did do that. It was a statement of interest. And it's very telling as to how this court should view the government's interest in this action. In that state court action, they filed a brief which acknowledges that Blue Cross acts as not an agent of the government, but acts on its own behalf. It functions as an independent economic entity that offers and runs their own health insurance plans. This is not a situation like in Boyle, where the government is specifying how something should be done in a contract, and then the defense contractor is...
Mr. Shelley said that if there were a dispute over benefits, Cruz would have to sue the government rather than Blue Cross.
Correct, and that is a very important point. The FEBA statute provides for a jurisdictional provision which is limited to disputes where the government is a party defendant. This action is a dispute between private parties. The government is not involved. As Mr. Shelley indicated, they asked the OPM to be involved in this case, and they decided not to for whatever reason. And we believe that it's because...
Well, it's involved in the sense mm-hmm. that this government with the contract, this contract with the government bars your type of claim.
Well, the contract that they raise here is silent on the issue of attorney's fees. There's no provision in that contract that indicates attorney's fees should not be reduced under a common fund theory.
He says it's in a brochure which is incorporated by reference.
The brochure is something that is developed, written...
But it's incorporated into the government
contract. It is not incorporated. It's authorized by the OPM to be issued by Blue Cross, but the OPM has no involvement in the language in that particular document. If you look on the first page of that document, it says authorized...
But doesn't the government contract refer to the brochure? I mean, not by name, but refer to the terms that Blue Cross works out with the enrollees?
All it indicates is that the statement of benefits should comport with the contract. And the contract says that the contract should comport with the FEBA statute and regulations. Nowhere in the FEBA statute or regulations does it thwart, or is there any congressional intent to thwart a common fund claim as we have in this instance.
And there's no reference to policies being adopted by the government since it's in this brochure?
Correct. There's no reference at all. With respect to, there's a reference to the statement of benefits being issued, but in terms of what should be included in that statement of benefits, it has to comport with the contract, and that contract has to comport with congressional intent over FEBA plans. And it's clear when you look at the statute that Congress intended to preempt only those issues that have to do with coverage and benefits. And it's clearly at odds with what we have at issue here, which is...
Is that what the brochures... Are the brochures the one are used at the enrollment each year? Is that what the brochure you're talking about?
Correct, Your Honor. The brochure is what is handed out to the participants by Blue Cross.
Right.
It's not a brochure that is developed by OPM, and it's not a brochure where the OPM is directing Blue Cross to put these provisions in.
But doesn't OPM approve them?
It authorizes Blue Cross to issue it, but it should be issued in conformity with the contract and statute that overrides that particular statement. And that sort of...
Well, Blue Cross says, this is page 9 of its brief, says the statement of benefits for the service benefit plan is incorporated into the OPM-BC-BSA contract. Is that correct?
That is not correct. It's not a separate document that is incorporated by the OPM in the contract with Blue Cross. It's an authorization by OPM to allow Blue Cross to issue a statement, which Blue Cross develops on its own, as OPM acknowledges in its brief in the state court. In its reply brief in this action on page 22, Blue Cross acknowledges that it has discretion to do what it did in this case, which was to deny a fund doctrine offset against this reimbursement. But what's more important to also acknowledge is that the FEBA statute gave a clear, precise jurisdictional provision which only allows lawsuits against OPM in federal court. All other suits that have nothing to do with actions against OPM, which would include denial of benefit type of issues, not these issues that we have at issue here, all those suits have to be filed in state court. And that's what we did in our action. We filed a claim on behalf of Mr. Cruz over a year before Blue Cross filed this action in federal court to adjudicate their denial of a fund doctrine claim. And that issue should be kept in state court, and this action is clearly a collateral attack on that particular litigation. And as Judge Kaney indicated in his question, we do not deny a reimbursement right to Blue Cross. They allege our complaint in their action, which is an acknowledgement that the only dispute between the parties is one of whether or not they should be reducing their reimbursement claim by the fund doctrine.
You quote in your own brief on page 21 a statement in the plan saying this brochure, which I take it is the brochure that contains the collective fund provision, this brochure is based on text incorporated into the contract between OPM and the carrier.
Is based on text incorporated into the contract. It's not a document that OPM had any involvement in compiling. This is a
That's
document.
That's true, but OPM could write. Can OPM write a blank check and say that, you know, we trust you, Blue Cross, and so anything you put in your brochure will be a part of our contract. In other words, we'll be bound to, you know, fund whatever commitments you undertake.
Well,
isn't that the effect of that?
If that was allowed to happen, Your Honor, it would not comport with what Congress intended the FEBA statute to address, and that was coverage and benefit.
No, I understand your argument about the statute curtailing this type of litigation, but I'm trying to get straight whether, in fact, this provision barring collective fund doctrine should be regarded as a part of the federal contract.
Well, there's two reasons why it should not be. And the first is this court's decision in Northrop versus AIL, where the court there addressed a teaming agreement between a defense contractor and a subcontractor. And there was a authorization by the government to allow this sort of teaming agreement to be in place, and there's also a regulation that addressed that this teaming agreement should be allowed as well. And there was a dispute between the subcontractor and the defense contractor where the subcontractor tried to sue under that policy and asserted a federal common law claim should be heard on that particular dispute. The court rejected it and said that authorization alone isn't enough of a significant federal interest to allow this action to be heard in federal court. The second point to make on that issue is that this particular provision that they point to is vague or ambiguous at best. It states that the plan has any reduction in the plan's reimbursement claim is subject to prior approval of the plan.
What's ambiguous about that?
Well, it's ambiguous in the sense as to when, how, and why.
No, it's not ambiguous. It says they're reserving the right of approval of this.
Well, that undercuts
so what?
Their...
What's an ambiguous?
Well, Judge Posner, that undercuts their uniformity argument, saying that The reason why we have to preempt all these
state
laws.
Want the uniform discretion to turn down these you know, collective fund requests. There's nothing ambiguous about that.
Well, it's hard to imagine something being uniform and both uniform and discretionary at the same time.
No, you can want to have discretion in all your contracts, right? That's uniform.
Well, Your Honor, I think the point I'm trying to make is borne out by the facts in this case, where, and this was missing from the appellant's brief.
Anyway, that's completely empty, that provision, because whatever the contract says, a contracting party can always renounce a right in its contract, right?
Well, I mean, the contracting party here is not. We're not talking about a contract between Blue Cross and OPM. We're talking about a document that Blue Cross
created
on its
own. Right. If someone came to Blue Cross and said, you know, we want to make a deal with you, and you let us deduct our attorney's fees from what we pay you back, and we'll bring this lawsuit, and you'll be better off, we'll be better off. Blue Cross could agree to that, couldn't it? Whatever the brochure said.
They could, but it's not a situation that the federal government should be involved in, which this is what they're trying to do, is they're trying to create this...
Well, the federal government has an interest. Apparently they think that health reimbursement for federal employees will be lower if this right is withheld from them.
Your Honor, that sort of argument was rejected by this court in the Blackburn versus Sunstrand case, where there was an argument that the federal treasury might be affected by not allowing an offset under the common fund doctrine. You know, it's a speculative, remote argument that has no basis. They have no factual foundation for that. And in fact, you know, the opposite effect could occur, where there's a chilling effect on personal injury lawsuits.
Right, that's possible.
And that argument should go to the wayside on that basis alone.
Does the fact that the federal judiciary is covered by the same plan make any difference, FIBA?
The federal judges?
We're all involved in it.
Well, I think you're...
Not necessarily Blue Cross or Blue Shield, but there are other plans available, and we're all covered by the Federal Employees Health Benefit Act.
Well, there's no conflict for Your Honors to hear this case. I can assure you, unless you have a personal injury action where you were denied by Blue Cross a offset under the fund doctrine.
Not in this case,
not
particularly.
Yet.
But depending on whether we say there's federal preemption, for the reason that it affects the plan... And rates.
Well, the point is whether or not this is a direct effect on the federal treasury, and whether or not insurance rates will increase if you deny our fund doctrine offset. And there's no showing of that. It's pure speculation.
I just raise it as an issue because it crossed my mind.
Well, and also, Blue Cross isn't the only carrier that the OPM contracts with. There's several contractors, and it's highly doubtful that there's not going to be competition that's going to be that will work its way through to ensure that, you know, this sort of a claim that's litigated in state court, which it arose from and which it should still be addressed in, that's not going to, you know, be resolved. I think the competition aspect of it is going to assure that, you know, this small issue will not be a deciding factor as to premium or rate increases. And actually, we believe that it's going to, you know, help to have to incentivize people to pursue the action, because Blue Cross is sitting on their hands not doing anything, and they should bear the burden of at least making sure that they pay their fair share of the cost, as the Illinois Common Fund Doctrine requires them to do. Your Honor, we point out in our a lot of the cases that Blue Cross relies upon are actions that involve denial of benefits, and we have no dispute that a denial of benefit couldn't be heard in federal court. That's what the jurisdictional provision of FIBA, allows for. Suits against the OPM when OPM denies a benefit action. And that was the case that the Seventh Circuit heard and decided in Harris, in which the counsel raised with the court today. In that action, the court never reached the issue of federal common law, which is the basis that Blue Cross stands here to try to get this court to create and in terms of trying to provide them jurisdiction over this issue. See that
okay.
My time is...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Carr. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shelley, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
I'd like to point the court to section 2.2 of the contract, which is on the appendix. I guess it's volume 2, page 354, which specifically says in section 2.2A, the carrier shall provide the benefits as described in the certified brochure text found in Appendix A. Also in section 2.5, a few pages later, page 357 of the appendix, it says the carrier's subrogation rights, procedures and policies, including recovery rights, shall be in accordance with the provisions of the certified brochure text. They're part of the... They become part of the text as
well. Is it reviewed by the government before you issue?
Absolutely. In fact, it's negotiated for 9 months, and for Mr. Carnews to argue that government has nothing to do with it is simply utterly false.
You mean the brochure?
The brochure. It's negotiated between the parties, and I would point the court to the Doe versus Devine decision by Justice Ginsburg, then Judge Ginsburg, who discussed at length the process for creating the brochures in this program. And in fact, in that case, there was a challenge to a provision of the benefits in the brochure. It was brought as an action against the United States and the carrier, but the court looked at it as United States decision-making and reviewed it under an arbitrary and capricious test under the Administrative Procedure Act. I'd also point the court to the Caudill decision of the Fourth Circuit, where the Fourth Circuit said that brochure is actually a federal regulation because it's drafted by the government, promulgated by the government, and applies to large groups of people with future effect, and therefore it meets the test under the APA for a rule. So it's not only a part of the contract, the brochure provision, but it's also a government regulation and essentially we're here seeking to enforce.
Does the government impose this on all the carriers who administer the federal employee health benefits?
The reimbursement terms?
Yeah.
I can't say. Ours is the largest plan covering 50% of the federal employees, and it's clearly in ours. I know another. I don't necessarily believe that the reimbursement provision is exactly the same in every other plan, but the point of uniformity was uniformity within a plan because everybody pays the same premium in the plan, and therefore, if you don't do things uniformly, a party in one state who's not getting who's getting the benefit of state law on reimbursement, anti-subrogation policies, is subsidizing the recovery and the special rights that a party in another state is going to get.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument.